Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications.
Hello, and welcome to Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. This episode, we'll be talking about rail blockades and real politics with Ottawa correspondent David Fraser. John Gregg of Farmtario will be joining us to talk about a cannabis backlash. And Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm will make sense of the markets for us. But up first is Geraldine Witchers of the Manitoba Cooperator. She'll tell us all about a pair of Rivers, Manitoba sisters that are taking their farm online in high style through a fashion and farming Instagram account. Geraldine, thanks for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.
So who are the Lepp sisters and how did you hear about them?
So people who follow them on Instagram will know them as the two Lepps, Cassandra and Stephanie Lepp. They are sisters who farm together near Rivers, which is in western Manitoba.
And how did you hear about them?
On Instagram. However one finds people on Instagram, that's what I did.
So for those who aren't initiated, can you tell us a little bit about Instagram? Because I think that some of us know about it, some of us don't. Myself included. I know a little bit about it.
You're kind of like, that's kind of like asking a fish to describe water, isn't it? okay, so yeah, it's a lot of sharing pictures. So pictures with a short like text caption with it.
And so then what are they doing with this platform?
So what they have is quite a well-followed Instagram page where they post a combination of sort of magazine-worthy fashion photography and sort of straight-up shots of them working on the farm. And often what they post is inspired by what they're doing that day. So if they're washing out the combine, then there's a picture of them doing that. Admittedly, quite a well-posed one. It's not just, you know, a random Dutch angled shot from someone's bad smartphone. But it's still just them cleaning the combine. And if they're hauling the canola to the elevator that day, then they're talking about that. And they're talking about how trade issues affect commodity prices and how little control they have over that. So it's not just sort of cutesy animal pictures, even though, of course, we love that. It's actually can get quite in-depth sometimes.
So, and why are they doing it? Why are they combining these two sort of what are I would have previously thought to be unique worlds or divergent worlds?
Yeah, so initially it started because they saw agriculture being kind of misrepresented in media or even vilified, and they wanted to do something that would give a positive voice. But they figured, well, if we just post pictures of farming, we're going to get farming followers, and that would kind of defeat the purpose. And so it happens that they are both quite interested in fashion. Stephanie is quite a good photographer. So they decided to go that direction instead because they thought it would broaden their audience, and it seems to have done that.
So to them, there's a real sort of education component to it. What are you talked a little bit about it previously. What are the things that they're taking on kind of in their day-to-day?
Quite a broad spectrum of things because, of course, the tasks on the farm is varied as the days. Like I said, they recently posted about commodity prices and trade issues. But they've also tackled things like chemicals because, you know, there's a picture of them bringing home flats of chemicals from the dealer and talking about, hey, this is why we use that. And they told me, you know, it's not like we're great proponents of chemical use, but we understand that is just something that we do right now to provide food for all the people out in the world who want to eat. So they also talked about like, hey, here's the spray coming out of the boom, but that's actually not as much chemical as you might think. Apparently people have gotten a little heated on them when they've discussed stuff like that, but they're not afraid to tackle the hard issues.
And so how successful have they been? Are people listening? What's their following like?
They have just under 14,000 followers, so that's pretty good. That's pretty up there on Instagram. And yeah, they have people who follow them from around the world, and they have heard back from people through messages, emails, comments that, hey, we didn't really know much about agriculture until we read your posts. And they've also gotten really good feedback when they've posted about mental health. They've had their own brushes with mental health issues, and so they told me that they're quite passionate about making it something that is okay to talk about. Some of us have heard stats about how many farmers there are out there who have issues with anxiety and depression. And so they're quite open about how hard farm life can be. And they've had a lot of good responses from that as well.
So for our interested listeners, where can they find the LEPS presence? The Two LEPS, is it, on Instagram?
Yes, it's the Two LEPS. Just search the Two LEPS. I think that's all one word. Yeah.
Well, great. Thanks, Geraldine. That was the Manitoba Cooperator's Geraldine Witchers telling us about a pair of fashionable farmers from the Rivers, Manitoba area. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. Up a bit later in the program, Ottawa correspondent David Fraser will tell us about the politics of rail blockades, and Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm will fill us in on the latest action. But first, here's Farmtario editor John Gregg to tell us about a brewing backlash over cannabis in the countryside. John, thanks for being here.
No problem, Gord.
So can you tell us a bit about the cannabis industry in Ontario and why it's causing some upset?
Recreational cannabis was legalized, was about October 2018, so not all that long ago. The companies that had a whole lot of money pour into them had to find places to grow cannabis. They were kind of into it a bit before with medical cannabis, but the real money and work flowed once the recreational cannabis was licensed. And we already grow high-value crops in southern Ontario and greenhouses. The largest greenhouse group in North America is located in southern Ontario, so that's where a lot of the money flowed, and there were a lot of greenhouses purchased in the Niagara area and in the Leamington area, especially where they started to grow cannabis. Now, those greenhouses had worked just fine for growing fruits and vegetables nearby, berries, mostly vegetables and berries. But there's about three reasons why cannabis is different. The first is the smell. So fruits, vegetables, peppers and tomatoes and cucumbers, the production of those in greenhouses don't really cause much odor. But cannabis certainly has a distinctive odor when you have that many plants growing in one area, especially around harvest time. And in the Niagara area especially, where there's a fairly dense population, a lot of these greenhouses for 15 or 20 years or more have been backed into in the area of residential places where people had houses. So now you have a bit of a smell that wasn't there before. Secondly, is the light. If you're growing peppers and tomatoes, you're lighting it to grow those vegetables and fruit. If you're growing cannabis, you're trying to grow leaves. And leaves, you can pile a lot more light to a plant if you're just focusing on trying to grow the green leaves. And as a result, there's a whole lot more light pollution with a cannabis greenhouse, and that's got some people concerned. Some people say they can see the glow from a cannabis greenhouse from 20 kilometers away. And then the third thing is cannabis operations employ more people, which isn't necessarily a bad thing for rural areas. But when you have people with an expectation of a certain amount of vehicle traffic and people traffic into a facility, and it's been that way for a long time, and then suddenly it doubles or triples or quadruples, then that causes a bit more concern. So those are the main three issues.
It's interesting, though. Some of those sound pretty similar to some complaints and concerns I've heard of other perhaps less colorful farming operations, hog operations, for example. So isn't some of this stuff covered under legislation, under legitimate farming operations, as they say?
Yeah, it definitely is. So and currently, that's the tack that a lot of the farm organizations take. This is a legitimate farming, crop growing enterprise, which it is, and it's protected under our right to farm legislation. But I see quite a bit of similarities with the time period when larger livestock barns, especially hog barns, showed up here in Ontario and across the rest of the country, and there's some interesting parallels. So there were concerns about traffic and concerns about smell and concerns about water quality, just like there are with the cannabis operations. And what eventually had to happen, and municipalities, local municipalities had protesters, a lot of concerns, their own planning issue concerns, and didn't have a lot of guidance to go on. So a lot of them put in what we call here interim control bylaws, which basically sets a year pause or a certain period of time pause on development. And that's what happened with hog barns, and that's what's happening with these cannabis operations, especially in the Niagara Peninsula. And what eventually had to happen is that the province had to step in, and we created what's called our Nutrient Management Act here that really set the rules across the province for hog barns. It set minimum distance separations, well-researched minimum distance separations, and it cost farmers more money, but they were able to get their barns built. And now it's not. You hear occasional times, but people can get larger barns built here because there's provincial standards and kind of established priorities. There really haven't been those established for cannabis. They kind of have gone into existing buildings, really, in a lot of cases, and used them for uses that have had more impact on the nearby community, which is why it's kind of happening.
So, is there some backlash simply because of the product we're talking about?
So, I expect there is some of that, but in talking to a bunch of the people who are doing the backlash, who have the concerns, they take pains to say they're not particularly necessarily against cannabis production. They just want it to be in the right place where it's not backed up against residential, your residential areas. There was a report several people told me about a school that had to keep their kids in at certain times during certain periods of the cannabis growth cycle because of the smell. Now, the school wouldn't confirm that, but it's kind of a practical backlash, but they made pains to say that they weren't particularly against cannabis, but they just say it needs proper best management practices, which they're really. We really don't have set in Ontario because this has been such a fast developed sector, and some of them said they really wish the federal government had said, hey, we're going to pick four places across the country, and in this municipality or this region, yes, you can set up X number of cannabis operations, and then you'd learn, what distance separations do you need, what practices do you need. What community impacts are there before it just kind of exploded into the countryside? But there's probably a little bit of backlash because of the product, but it was less than I expected when I talked to the people who were concerned about it.
So it sounds to me like we're in the process of finding some middle ground here, and in terms of what the local community can handle while letting people go about what is now a lawful business.
And I think that's it. And I think when you have a sector that grows extremely rapidly with an enormous amount of capital, with a lot of people who have come into the cannabis sector are not farmers. In fact, there's, other than a few greenhouse operators that are involved in it, a lot of the money and the entrepreneurs that have come into it are not people who are farmers. There's a lot of land that's been bought up in the Niagara Peninsula, for example, by pharmacy companies and medical distribution companies and things like that, with plans to jump into the cannabis business, and I think that there just needs to be a bit of an adjustment time period where the people who live in the countryside get used to the new neighbors, but also with the new neighbors get to understand a little bit about what they need to do to fit in where they are.
Well, thanks a lot for filling us in on this, John.
No problem, Gordon.
That was Farmtario editor John Gregg talking about why some rural residents in Ontario aren't that excited about the budding cannabis sector. You're listening to Between the Rows, and I'm your host this week, Gord Gilmore. In just a bit, we'll be talking with Markets Farm reporter Glenn Halleck about the latest action. But first, we're joined by Glacier Farm Media's Ottawa correspondent David Fraser. He'll talk about the story that's been gripping the nation, rail blockades by Indigenous protesters. So I understand you're fresh from a news conference from the Canadian Federation of Agriculture on this topic. While it's fresh in your mind, what were the major themes of this event?
Yeah, so Mary Robinson, the executive director of the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, was really stressing that time is running out when it comes to these rail blockades and the impact that it's having on the industry. She said a number of times that the industry is reaching a tipping point, and it's getting to the point where it's going to be beyond just a financial hardship as propane supplies run out, and real impacts are going to be felt on the farm soon. And she stressed that farmers really have nothing to do with these protests and are sort of stuck in the middle of the two factions that are going back and forth.
Now, generally speaking, how's this whole thing been playing out in Ottawa? I've certainly heard a lot of calls for action, but I also kind of suspect the federal government, their reaction to this situation has been measured on purpose and out of necessity. What's your take on this?
Yeah, so I mean, it's worth noting that the Liberal government has now convened an incident response group to deal with this issue and other major issues facing the federal government at this time. And as you mentioned there, they're continuing to take a bit of a measured approach and find a peaceful resolution to this. But in my mind, they're kind of once again stuck in the middle of what their actions are and what they profess to be doing to the public. They've said a number of times that they're committed to dialogue, but the barricades have to come down first. And they've so far restricted calls from the Canadian or from the Conservative Party to force the physical removal of the barriers. But they're in this position where they preach how much they want reconciliation with Canada's First Nations people, but at the same time, there's this need to keep the economy moving. And in this instance, much like we've seen over other protests around pipelines, these two worlds don't always meet. So the government is stuck in this position of wanting reconciliation and to do right by First Nations people, but also wanting to keep the economy of Canada strong and moving. So they're in a bit of a tough spot. One of the reasons, I think, why they're sort of continuing to buy time and say, okay, let's try and find a peaceful resolution and move along slowly through dialogue here.
So it really does sound like sort of a stuck-in-the-middle kind of a situation for the federal government. Are there pitfalls that somebody like myself, a layperson, might not be aware of? What are the things that are kind of surprising you as you find out a little bit more about this?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think the stuck-in-the-middle is something that a lot of people aren't recognizing and is this debate goes on. I think the other thing that people need to recognize in all of this is that there's a bit of a complicated legal matter that's at the heart of all of this. Nobody, it seems, really sure as to who is responsible for making decisions on what can happen on the land in question. Is it the British Columbian government? Is it the federal government? Is it the elected First Nations along the pipeline's path? Or is it the hereditary chiefs of the Wet'suwet'en Nation? And so I think that's sort of adds to the complication of who's responsible for this.
So is there a bit of an emerging sense that this is going to be a long-term risk? Are we going to see further barricades? Do you feel like it's going to kind of wind its way to a relatively quick conclusion? Or am I just asking you to unfairly dust off your crystal ball here?
Yeah. Well, my crystal ball is extremely dusty because I really have no idea. I will say that there's no real indication right now that the end is near. While we have seen police move in on a few blockades to make arrests, the opposition to the Coastal GasLink project is not going away, and we're also seeing an emboldening, I think, of public support for the protests. We're seeing protests pop up in cities across Canada. Here in Ottawa, there was a major protest in support of the folks in BC at the Capitol building here in Ottawa. So unless there's some sort of major development in the next few days, I don't see this ending anytime soon.
So what we're really talking about are sort of short-term impacts of a longer-term situation. I think that a lot of the Indigenous people in Canada are frustrated. So are we looking at long-term solutions then on the horizon? And if so, what are some of those long-term solutions?
Yeah, so again, I think that's a really difficult question to ask right now. But at the heart of it, I think all Canadians need to recognize and continue to recognize just how important reconciliation is with Indigenous Canadians. I believe the more we go down that path towards reconciliation, the less we will have to address issues such as the one that we're dealing with now. But there's also some more tangible benefits or more tangible actions that can take place outside of just reconciliation. We're hearing from some groups at the CFA AGM that I'm attending today. There's some calls for essential services, passing essential services legislation for the railways so that when instances such as this take place, the federal government already has the jurisdiction to immediately step in and say, no, railways are an essential service. We need to keep them moving. And there's no real question as to the morality of whether or not the police should go in and remove the barricades like we're having now. That would kind of eliminate that because it would already be in the law and something that we have decided as elected officials or elected officials had already decided. So that's something that could address, you know, the issue at hand with the railways. But truly, I do think it's reconciliation with First Nations people that needs to be addressed here.
Well, David, thanks for filling us in.
Yeah, thanks again so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was Glacier Farm Media Ottawa correspondent David Fraser. I'm Gord Gilmore, and you're listening to Between the Rows, the podcast of Glacier Farm Media. Now, to wrap up the show, we're joined by Markets Farm Commodities reporter Glenn Halleck to fill us in on the latest action. Glenn, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Gord.
So we've heard plenty about rail blockades earlier in the show, but I know that that's got to have an impact on the markets. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the rail blockades haven't quite affected prices just yet, but what's coming? What is inevitable is it's backing things up with the railways. CN says they're looking at taking 3 to 4 weeks to undo this backlog, and eventually that's going to hit the ports. There's going to be ships waiting for canola, for wheat, for soybeans, and it's not going to be there, and that's going to drive up. Drive down prices for the farmers.
So it comes down, it sounds like to me, to uncertainty. That's kind of the watchword of the market these days, it seems. One area I've been watching is basically value evaporating on the stock exchanges due to the coronavirus concerns. What impact is that having?
Coronavirus has had some effect for the last few weeks, but as of Monday, the stock markets dropped 2 to 3%. Canola on Monday dropped $8.50. Again today, another drop. The big thing is demand. The coronavirus is threatening demand, and that just has this big ripple effect, you know, through the commodities markets, through the stock markets.
So generally, then, what else are you keeping your eye on these days?
Well, we have Federal Agriculture Minister Marie-Claude Bibeau saying that Parliament will soon pass the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, which will replace NAFTA. And also she said that talks between Canada and China in resolving, you know, that 14-month-old diplomatic dispute are put on hold, all because of a coronavirus.
Well, thanks, Glenn.
Well, thank you, Gord.
That was Glenn Halleck of Markets Farm with the latest from the commodity markets. That's another edition of Between the Rows from Glacier Farm Media. I'm your host, Gord Gilmore, saying so long, and we hope you'll join us again next week.
Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com or visit us at membersgetmore.ca. And sign up today.